Welcome back. There were 163 workhouses operating in this country from the 1840s until the early 1920s. They were feared and loathed institutions, and the very last place people wanted to end up. Consultant psychiatrist Professor Brendan Kelly, who researched conditions in 19th century workhouses, took Colette Kinsella on a virtual tour.
I think the first thing that would strike you standing in a workhouse is likely the smell. Ventilation was a huge issue in these kinds of buildings, and they all had difficulties with sanitation, with food. Something else that might strike you would be the level of noise. They all had difficulties with overcrowding. There tended to be shouting, and these places could be quite noisy at nighttime as well.
Most of the 130 workhouses built after 1839 were based on a design by an architect named George Wilkinson. His brief was to design a building that was cheap, durable and plain, and each was to accommodate between 400 and 800 of the country's so-called deserving poor. But at the height of the starvation, thousands converged at the doors. In some workhouses, the population doubled, and as Dr. Gerard Moran explains, conditions were unbearable.
In Galway, for example, you have five people sleeping to the one bed.
Before asylums were established, workhouses also housed the mentally ill. And in the packed dormitories, people with typhus and dysentery were stretched out beside desperately ill or incontinent inmates. The death rate skyrocketed.
You're talking about 30 to 40 deaths per week.
The workhouse regime was harsh, and it started as soon as people walked through the door. They were washed, deloused, and given a workhouse uniform. There was also strict segregation for males and females, and entire families were split up.
From 2 to 15, you had a separate section for children. The rationale was that people would only use the workhouses as a very last resort. And if you were going to be segregated and split up, this is what happened.
Workhouses were run by so-called boards of guardians, and they met once a week to discuss things like discipline or food. There were generally two meals a day, which were kept at subsistence level.
For example, in 1847, in the Ballinrobe workhouse, the basic diet included 2 pints of new milk per day, up to 1 loaf of white bread per day, supplemented by 1 pint of buttermilk in the period immediately following admission to the workhouse.
The regime was strict. The day began early, and in some places the inmates worked up to 11 hours a day. But when workhouse numbers swelled, the work dried up and people were left with nothing to do. There was tension and unrest, and unruly behaviour was met with harsh discipline.
For the more severe punishments, solitary confinement for 24 to 48 hours.
In some cases, there were deaths.
We do note that the master in Ballinrobe workhouse was brought before the courts on a charge of murder where a pauper boy of 9, he had beaten him to death.
But with so many people living in such demoralising conditions, incidences of murder and suicide were not uncommon.
And there is significant evidence of young unmarried mothers engaging occasionally in infanticide.
Unmarried servant women were often sent to the workhouse when they became pregnant.
And often they saw no way out of the workhouse, no future within a workhouse quite clearly. And she would lose hope for herself and often for her child as well, with tragic consequences.
By 1851, there were 250,000 people living in workhouses, and most of them were women.
Partly on account of the fact that many of the males have emigrated and have left them behind until such time as they're in a position to be able to send for them.
And they tended to remain there because, with few jobs available, there was little hope of a decent life on the outside.
Colette Kinsella reporting there on life and death in Irish workhouses. Now, one of the ways that we can learn about what life was like in these institutions is by studying the remains and the burial sites of the people who lived in them. I'm joined by human osteoarchaeologist Linda Lynch, who's just done that in Manor Hamilton, Cashel and Tuam workhouses. Linda, you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thanks, Miles. Okay,
explain first of all what it is you do. What is osteoarchaeology?
Well, an osteoarchaeologist is someone who has been trained in archaeology, so that's the primary qualification, and then goes on to specialise in the analysis of bone And in particular, this relates to human remains.
Yeah, you're a human osteoarchaeologist, so you specialise in human rather than animal remains.
Animal bones tends to be referred to as zoo archaeology.
All right. And when a human skeleton is uncovered during the course of an archaeological investigation or excavation, how do archaeologists construct, how would you construct a picture of that individual and who that person might have been?
Well, it starts from literally from the moment a burial is uncovered, in that the excavation is undertaken in a very scientific manner in order to preserve as much information as possible about the burial itself. And it's afterwards, when we get the bones back into the lab, that we start the analysis of the skeletal remains themselves.
There's a bit of a CSI element to all of this, yes. But obviously the skeleton in situ is very, very important. And then eventually, when you've done all the work you need to do there, it's removed and you do other tests on it.
Yes. It's the actual burial itself is, I would argue, equally as important as the bones themselves, because it can tell us about the individual that is buried there, but more so it tells us about the society that buried that individual, because the dead don't bury themselves. It's the living that impose certain conditions on the burial of the dead. So ultimately, the living will decide where an individual is buried, how they are buried, based on their interpretation of the individual who has died.
What kind of information were you looking for? What were you trying to find out? What were you trying to learn about the people who were buried in workhouses?
There's so much documentary evidence relating to the workhouses and the individuals, I suppose, that went into them. We were looking at it in terms of what could the skeletal remains, I suppose, confirm what the history records, or whether it varies in some particular aspect. And I mean, there's a standard way of analysing skeletons to begin with. And once we have that basic picture built up of the demographic profile and various other aspects, that's when you start looking at that particular group in the context of the time period from which they are from.
Yeah, and one of the things that you would assume about anybody who went into a workhouse was that they were of extremely low socioeconomic status, that they were dirt poor,
yes,
to put it bluntly. And is that borne out by the skeletal remains?
Yes, it is. Poverty is considered a sin almost in the 19th century. This is their punishment, that they will be locked, that they will be kept away from society until they can contribute against society. But an important factor to consider as well is that you weren't actually meant to die in the workhouses, that the individuals that we were recovering from the workhouse cemeteries are even the most extreme of the poor individuals, in that they died in the workhouses. They never got out of them. Mm. So they were, when they went into the workhouses, now they could have lived for 15 years in those workhouses, or they might have died within 6 months of going in the doors, but they were the most desperate of the poor.
And again, one would assume that a majority of them, or an awful lot of them, would have been from around the famine period. Are you able to fix a date at which these people died?
As a number of the cemeteries, particularly Manor Hamilton Workhouse, the burials from there have been pinpointed to about 1847 by Moore Group Archaeology, but they're very specifically dated. But then the other ones from Cashel and from Tuam workhouses, they haven't been specifically dated, but we're looking at the context of recovery. And the Tuam skeletons were recovered in what we would call mass burial pits. And that indicates severe stress on a population being interred. So they are likely to be from the famine period. And again, with Cashel, they're buried within the confines of the workhouse itself, but the location of them was utterly forgotten. We are looking into that in terms of their individuals, again, that died during a severe period of stress and were conveniently buried within the walls of the workhouse.
And what about their ages? So is there a big age range? Are there a lot of children, or are there a lot of old people?
In general, there's almost half and half children and adults. And we would expect that. You'd expect a lot of children in workhouses in the very early decades of the workhouse. But not very young children. You tend not to get as many infants as you would expect. Most of the juveniles are aged between about 1 and 6 years of age. And then the age range is slacking off until after 25 years of age. And then you've a big group again between 25 and 45 years of age. There's still a substantial amount that are older than 45 years of age.
Yeah, I mean, listening to you, people would say, oh, that there aren't that many old people. But a 45-year-old in the 1840s with low socioeconomic status, that was probably quite old.
Yes, like that's a perhaps a good innings, as they would say. But like on saying that, while I'm saying there is a lot of individuals between the ages of 25 and 45, there's still over a quarter of the adults are aged 45 years and older. So there's still a substantial amount that are old adults.
And are there more women than men?
Interestingly, there's equal numbers of females and males coming out of the cemeteries of what we've excavated to date. Again, the one thing to consider with archaeological excavations is that it's only a sample of the individuals that would have died in the workhouses anyway. But it's interesting in that there's certainly records saying that more women went into the workhouses. I think at one stage it was over 70% in workhouses, almshouses, are women in the 19th century. But the skeletal evidence is showing half and half females and males.
And what about the physical stature of the kind of person who would have died in a workhouse? Are they smaller than the rest of the population?
Yes, significantly so. Again, documentary evidence suggests that the Irish peasant was very tall at the time in the 19th century. There's so many records, and it's been borne out from economic historians examining military records and naval records in England and in Australia and indeed in Ireland. And their records of the Irish statures are that the Irish are taller than their British counterparts in general. And we're seeing time and time again that the Irish pauper is substantially smaller than their counterparts in Britain at the time, even of the poor.
Yeah, how were they buried? Were the bodies simply thrown into mass graves? Even if there weren't mass graves, were they given the dignity of a coffin or a shroud? Or how were they buried?
Interestingly, in all the workhouses that I've been involved in, at least six workhouses now at this stage, and all of them have evidence of coffins. Whether they are single, discrete burials, all lined up in a row as you would expect in any cemetery, or whether they're like in tomb where you're getting grave pits with multiple individuals being put into a single pit, they all have coffins.
Am I right to be surprised at that?
Certainly, there's.
I am.
There is a very strong tradition in Ireland that a lot of pauper burials didn't get the dignity of a coffin. Mm. And so we were, we
but
were
in
surprised.
Workhouses, well. They did.
Yeah, ironically. They did. And as well, there's even child coffins, for juveniles. But what we got in Manor Hamilton is you'd get adult coffins with up to three children buried inside them.
Right. This may all seem very remote to our listeners, but just to illustrate how recent, or relatively recent, I suppose, this whole episode in our history is, John Horne, a publican from Portumna, remembers now the local workhouse when he was a boy.
My best memory of the workhouse was the very first time that I had to go deliver groceries for my father up to a woman who lived up there, Nora White. I was only, let's say, about 6 years of age maybe or so, And I wasn't very tall at the time, and the nettles were actually taller than myself. I knocked on the door, and you could hear the hollow sound inside, and I knocked again, and there was nothing happened. But after a minute or two, I heard a noise from inside of another door opening, and feet shuffling down along the corridor, and then the door opened, and I got the fright of my life. This woman was all in black. She had a beard and a black hat on her. And she had a sheepdog with a back on it like a Shetland pony,
Can you imagine how frightening an encounter that would have been for a little boy? I'm joined on the line by Ursula Marmion, manager of the Irish Workhouse Centre in Portumna. In 2004, Ursula, your local community started a project of restoring the Portumna workhouse. What state was it in?
Well, Miles, when we actually went into the buildings, the ivy was just beginning to get to the roof, but really they were in quite good condition inside where rain hadn't started to get in. You could look at it in two ways. One, look at this monstrosity at the edge of town. Or two, look at these, apart from the story attached to the building, look at these fine stone buildings. It doesn't make economic sense to knock them or let them fall down.
And to what extent have you managed to restore them at this stage?
It's a work in progress. All of the seven workhouse buildings are intact. So we've re-roofed five of them. We've tidied up the whole site because it had become sort of a dumping ground over the years. what was the former girls' building that would have housed the girls' dormitories, that is fully restored. The women's dormitory and the small laundry building, we will be, you know, conserving and restoring those, but we won't be redeveloping. But we have our offices now in the first block. We house the visitor information for the area.
Yeah, because you've set up something called the Irish Workhouse Centre. You set that up 3 years ago. So what kind of things are going on there?
We did. People come in and they're guided through the original workhouse buildings, and we do our best to tell the story of the workhouse as an institution.
And you discovered something about George Wilkinson, the architect who designed the workhouse. What else did he do?
Wilkinson designed most of the workhouses in Ireland. He was just 24 years of age when he came over, and I think some of us have been working really hard on this project, so we decided we'd take a day off. Nothing to do with the workhouse. We were going to go to Dublin Zoo. And we did, and while there we were watching the elephants and reading the blurb on the elephant house. And when we looked again, the first elephant house in Dublin Zoo was actually designed by George Wilkinson.
So from paupers to elephants.
Exactly, and no getting away from it. Yeah.
Ursula, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Ursula Marmion, manager of the Irish Workhouse Centre in Portumna. Linda, I imagine there are human remains in the grounds of Portumna Workhouse that would have stories to tell. There must be, would there?
I would have no doubt. Most workhouses would have designated burial grounds associated with them, but from the examples that have been uncovered to date in the past decade, they could be human remains buried anywhere in association with the workhouses.
Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us and talking to us about the craft, the science of osteoarchaeology, Linda Lynch. And Linda will be among the speakers at a conference which takes place in Portumna called The Irish Workhouse Past and Present. And all are welcome. Full details on our website. And while you're there, you can also podcast this programme.